This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Before toxic assets and subprime mortgages, there was Enron. And the company's former CEO, Jeffrey Skilling, carried the day in the Supreme Court this morning. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 24th of June. Good to have you with us. The Enron case that the Supreme Court decided today about a law known as the Honest Services Statute is more complicated than it might seem. The justices said it's not enough that former CEO Jeffrey Skilling might have deprived Enron shareholders of an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. They sent it back down to a lower court for them to decide. And in the process, the justices might have made it harder to prosecute public corruption and white-collar crime. From Washington, Brett Neely has more.
Today's unanimous decision won't set Jeffrey Skilling free. But the Supreme Court sent parts of his case, and that of convicted newspaper CEO Conrad Black, back to lower courts for review. The court said the government applied the Honest Services Statute way too broadly. Former government prosecutor Randall Eliason says the law was commonly used to nail executives and public officials. But
the term is so broad, you could argue that anything that looks dishonest was maybe a federal crime, and that was the problem.
The ruling will have big implications, says law professor Bennett Gershman at Pace University.
The governor of Illinois is now being prosecuted under this law. The governor of Alabama was convicted under this law. The speaker of the New York State Senate was convicted under this law. So all of these convictions are vulnerable.
The court's decision means that prosecutors will have to show more than just dishonest behavior. Prosecutors will now have to prove bribery or kickbacks. But for corporate cases,
very frequently, there's not. Frequently, top officials in corporations have violated their duties to their shareholders for personal financial gain, and that will no longer be criminal conduct.
That's Melanie Sloan of the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. She's worried that today's decision ties prosecutors' hands. But former prosecutor Randall Eliason doesn't think any U.S. attorneys are going to lose sleep.
There are a lot of tools in the federal prosecutor's tool bag.
He says most fraud and corruption cases rely on lots of different charges. Throwing out the honest services charge won't make much of a difference. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
The government-owned mortgage lender Fannie Mae has had about enough of people walking away from their homes. Strategic default is what that's called. People packing up and moving out when they don't think the mortgage is worth paying anymore. Today, Fannie said it's getting tough. Strategic defaulters will be locked out of any new Fannie Mae-backed loans, which is a good chunk of the mortgages in this country, for 7 years, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
When real estate attorney Kathy West Olivetti heard about the new efforts by Fannie Mae, she was puzzled.
Wait a minute. What's a strategic default? How do you determine that somebody is really able to afford the mortgage or not? You know, what is a hardship?
Fannie Mae says it has clear guidelines to determine what a hardship is, and it'll be up to mortgage servicers to decide whether homeowners are walking away from loans they have the ability to pay. All Fannie Mae will do is apply the penalty if you strategically default on your mortgage, no Fannie-backed loan, for 7 years.
Realistically, they control about 25% to 30% of the mortgage market these days, so that's a real threat.
Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
On the other side, some people say we're not sure whether Fannie Mae will be around in 7 years.
Even before the new Fannie Mae policy, strategic defaults weren't risk-free. Borrowers typically take such a hit to their credit scores that they're unable to get another mortgage for years. And in some states, lenders can go after more than just the house in the case of foreclosure. Still, real estate lawyer Kathy West Olivetti says those punishments might be better than the alternative, borrowers throwing good money after bad.
They're being smart. I look at it as they're finally being smart about something.
And she says in her South Carolina practice, the number of strategic defaulters is growing by the day. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
For-profit colleges got a grilling from lawmakers today on Capitol Hill. Those kinds of schools get more than 90% of their revenue from the government, which is to say, you and me, in the form of tuition paid by federal student loans and grants. Students are piling up huge debts for for-profit degrees that sometimes don't pay off, and there is worry in Congress that taxpayers aren't getting their money's worth. Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Enrollment in for-profit universities jumped a staggering 225% over the past 10 years, and virtually all of those students rely on federal grants and loans to help pay their tuition. It costs the government billions of dollars a year. But almost half those students can't pay their loans back. Senator Tom Harkin says the schools get their money, but taxpayers get the tuition bill, and the students are saddled with debt.
That debt is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. It will follow them until the day they die. But the for-profit schools get the benefits.
For-profit colleges argue that in an unsteady economy, they've become a rock for students that many traditional universities turn away. Harris Miller is with the Career College Association, a group that represents for-profit colleges.
Our students are graduating in high numbers, particularly if you compare them to other schools that accept at-risk students.
That's not the experience Yasmin Issa had. She trained to be an ultrasound stenographer at the Sanford Brown Institute in White Plains, New York.
5 months after finishing the program, I had no prospects for employment, but still had a family to take care of, rent, bills, and now the outstanding student loans.
With the job market still very tight, more people like Yasmin will be looking to boost their career skills. Many of them will end up at for-profit colleges. The Senate plans a second hearing on the issue next month. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Traders had one eye firmly on Europe today, budget strikes, in Greece and France, and Wall Street sold off accordingly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama is going to be on the road tomorrow. Members of the group of eight industrialized countries will meet just north of Toronto, the Muskoka region of Ontario, to be precise. And then on Saturday, the G20 summit kicks off actually in Toronto. It's the first time these two meetings will be held back-to-back. Organizers say that's part of the reason the price tag is so high, about $1 billion all told. And the overall cost is, of course, controversial, but so too are some of the line items, as Sean Cole reports.
Originally, both of these summits were going to be in a small town in the pastoral Muskoka region, but the planners realized there wasn't enough room in the venue, so they moved the G20 down to Toronto. It was kind of a scramble. Still, says someone quite familiar with these get-togethers,
The cost is just simply unbelievable. I've never seen numbers such as this.
Which is troubling, considering who this person is.
I'm Paul Martin, and I am the former Prime Minister of Canada.
So if you don't know what could be costing so much, God help us.
Well, I would hope that that's not as high as we have to go to get an answer.
You don't think we have to go to God?
I would certainly hope not.
We can just go to Stephen Harper.
Yes, I think it's up to him.
I.e., the current prime minister. To be clear, most of the money is going towards security. But the government hasn't been any more specific than that. So a lot of Canadian taxpayers are up in arms about that and about another widely publicized aspect of these meetings.
You mean the fake lake?
I do. See, even though the summits are back-to-back and more than 100 miles apart, there's only one media center based in Toronto. A lot of the reporters can't go to Muskoka. So part of the media center has been decorated to look like Muskoka, with dock chairs and canoes and, yes, an artificial lake. It was originally reported that just the lake cost $2 million. Naturally, Prime Minister Harper's critics in Parliament had their way with it.
Speaker, the fact is that fake Lake Gate is infuriating Canadians.
But Harper said the $2 million bought them more than just a lake.
Mr. Speaker, what there is a $2 million marketing pavilion, Mr. Speaker. There are thousands of visitors.
The Experience Canada Pavilion. It has a bunch of exhibits. And the hope is that reporters will spend time in there, learn about Canada, taste Ontarian wines, and write positive tourism stories. Which raises the question, what are these meetings for again? But John Curtin, a summit expert at the University of Toronto, says these promotional tactics are nothing new.
The last time we held a summit in Toronto, we had a fake lake.
This was 1988.
It was a very little lake.
And it was outside.
But it was highly important in spreading a very favorable image of Toronto around the world.
How so?
It had a beaver in it.
A real beaver named Amick with her babies.
All of the international journalists fell in love with those beavers. So if I have one complaint, is that they didn't spend enough to bring the beavers back. All Torontonians should say to Mr. Harper, bring our summit beavers back.
That's not likely to happen. Polls show that most Canadians think these summits aren't worth the cost. But former Prime Minister Paul Martin, who pioneered the G20 summit, says they're still hugely valuable.
The purpose of the meeting is to deal with the global economy. And if as a result of the host country's leadership, we advance the yardsticks in this area, then let me tell you, the beauty of Canada will come forth.
Whether or not that's true, the Experience Canada Pavilion is now open. I've seen it, and it looks exactly how I expected. In Toronto, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
With that as background, then, let's turn to the actual substance of the meetings this weekend. For that, we've got our European correspondent, Stephen Beard, on the line from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
The big issue at the G8 this weekend, obviously, is fixing the global economy, sustaining the recovery. What are the details, though? How's it going to happen?
Well, this brings us down to a rift which has developed, a transatlantic rift between the US and Europe. The US arguing that we should keep the stimulus going, and various European countries, Germany in particular, saying, no, we should start cutting deficits. Government debt is the major threat to recovery.
As always at these things, there are nations there who are not technically members of the G8, and that's true this time as well, isn't it?
Yes, there are several African leaders in Huntsville attending this G8 meeting, and they're here to really make the argument that some of the earlier pledges of the G8, specifically those at Gleneagles in Scotland in 2005, have not been fully honoured. There's quite a discrepancy between the pledges and the aid that has been delivered.
2005, of course, a long time ago in economic time.
Indeed.
Lastly, Stephen, the G8, the G20, am I the only one who's wondering why they can't figure out how many people they want to have at the party?
No, there's a lot of people asking the same question and wondering whether, in fact, the time has come to abandon the G7 and the G8 as something from the past. The G20, they say, is where the future lies because this has got all the big, emerging, vibrant economies in it. However, there are some analysts who say there is a problem with the G20. It's too big. It's much harder to manage. Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank says the G20 certainly doesn't seem ready to get to grips with this issue of stimulus versus deficit cutting.
The problem is that it's terribly, terribly unwieldy, and the members of it have very, very different interests. The Koreans, for instance, who are the chairman of the G20 this year, simply aren't interested in what they see as being a Western European and US problem.
The French have been arguing that, in fact, what we probably need is something halfway between the G8 and the G20, a G14, perhaps, which would include the G8 plus half a dozen of the big emerging economies. And that, they say, might prove a more effective body for global economic decision making.
Not too big, not too small, just right. Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
We'll be right back. Coming up, is low-cost labor history?
Prices just won't go down. I mean, people were kind of used to prices for those kinds of things going down year after year. And I think the reality is it's just going to be harder to do that.
Our series on China's one-child policy continues. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 1.4% today, 145 points closed at 10,152. The Nasdaq retreated 1.2%, 36 points, 2217 at the bell. The S&P 500 also knocked off 1.2%, 18 points in all there, finished at 1,073. Retail shares had a really tough time today. Macy's plunged more than 6% over fears that consumers aren't ready to shop yet. JCPenney racked up a loss of 5.75%. Target missed the mark by more than 3.5% today. Financial shares followed suit. Morgan Stanley gave back more than 3%. Citigroup and Bank of America both tossed more than 2.5% back in the pond. Apple stores had a better day than Apple stock as the new iPhone hit the market. Apple shares fell 0.75% today, and that's all you'll hear us say about it. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its final gross domestic product report for the first quarter. Canine lovers, listen up. It's take your dog to work day. Maybe check with your boss first. And if the word is no Fido in your cube, consider option number two to bond with your pet. The world's ugliest dog contest. It all happens at the Sonoma Marin Fair in California. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. When you've got more than a billion people, you've got what economists call a surplus, in this case, of labor, more people than there's work for. In the industrial sense, that's been the case in China for most of the past 30 years. Western companies have come in, set up factories, and capitalized on the cheap labor. Today, as Marketplace's Scott Tong continues his series on China's one-child policy, he explains how the era of cheap and plentiful Chinese labor may be coming to a close.
A nondescript factory in Shaoxing, eastern China. Here, the $30 tank top from designer brand BCBG is born. About 100 Chinese workers sit, row by row, stitching. But several chairs are empty. Factory owner Shaoxing Mei can't find enough workers.
Every year it's worse. We have more and more workers who leave.
She'll have to raise wages again. Shao says workers these days are picky and soft, and the one-child policy means there are fewer available than, say, a decade ago. Back then, says economist Baiju Chen at the University of Southern California, bosses had the upper hand. They figured,
I'm the only place here, you know. Even though I pay you money, dirt cheap, you still have to come if you want looking for a job.
But these days,
we are going to see less workers. That is troublesome.
Top Chinese economists think the country has hit a turning point. In econo speak, the earlier labor surplus is now turning to labor shortage. Here's how it plays out at the tank top factory. This female worker stitched and got hitched to this male worker. But these two workers have produced just one to replace them in the next generation. Their daughter, 4-year-old Qi Xingji. Who currently belts out a Chinese version of Are You Sleeping in their factory dorm. Many rural Chinese are actually allowed to have two children. The one-child policy has exceptions, but often they don't want two. This low fertility rate means the number of workers in their early 20s is expected to shrink by half over the next decade. So, attention Walmart shoppers, the days of low-cost China may be numbered. Arthur Krober is with consultancy GavCal Dragonomics.
Prices just won't go down. I mean, people were kind of used to prices for those kinds of things going down year after year. And I think the reality is it's just going to be harder to do that.
Across Shaoxing, this labor shortage has factory owners fretting.
Water, labor, energy cost are all going up. At this rate, we can last 3 to 5 years at most, and then we'll have to shut down.
He's lost business to countries like Pakistan and Vietnam that have cheaper labor. But don't draft China's obituary just yet. Wage costs are just one piece of the pie. China beats the competition in other areas, like the efficiency of its ports, its customer service. Jerry DeCarmo of the clothing brand Luca Ferretto says Chinese factories treat him well.
They take you to the factory, they find hotels for you, they cater you. You know, the wine and dine that a lot of the American businessmen are looking for.
One businessman likens Chinese factory tours to Vegas. Great food, nice hotels, beautiful women who have been known to entertain after hours. DeCarmo knows that's part of the deal in China.
But since I'm married, I'm afraid of what kind of entertainment they might be wanting to introduce me to. So I try to find my own ways, you know, go see a kung fu show or something family-oriented. So.
Good answer. The tank top factory's answer to rising labor costs is to try something new. It created its own brand.
BCBG in America only pays us a wholesale price of $5 per item, but we have our own stores in China and charge much more than that.
But store business is slow. Sewing clothes is one thing. Retailing them is another. The manufacturing sector's main challenge, says economist Baiju Chen, is squeezing more out of fewer workers.
I just visited this toilet company, and they're talking about putting automated production line instead of relying on the workers.
You heard it here. Toilets will no longer say made by hand. In the end, China's labor squeeze could actually help the world. Let's go back to the tank top factory and the singing four-year-old. When she grows up, her labor will be in demand, unless China expands the labor pool by, for instance, relaxing the one-child policy. Barring that, her generation will make good money to buy things like American goods. And that could reduce China's nasty trade imbalance with the United States. In Shaoxing, eastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott wraps up his series tomorrow. He and I are going to talk about the future of China's one-child policy. In the meanwhile, see how closely you've been paying attention. There is a quiz on our website. I'm told it's not all that tough. It's at marketplace.org. Two words as we take the show down the pop music pipeline now. Justin Bieber. If you're a teenager or if you have one in your house, that name is going to mean something. For the rest of us, Justin Bieber is one of the top pop stars out there right now. He's on the radio all over the place, also on television. Here he is on David Letterman not too long ago. But it's not Justin Bieber we're going to talk about today. It's actually the guys singing behind him, four Filipino-Americans who go by the name Legacy. Josh Kuhn is here from the Annenberg School at the University of Southern California. Josh, great to have you back.
Absolutely. Thanks.
What's the big deal that these guys are Filipino-Americans?
Well, part of the big deal is that you just don't see many Filipino-Americans, or for that matter, Asian-Americans, on the pop charts or the R&B charts. So to suddenly see this quartet of guys on some of the biggest stages in American pop music is a big deal.
How did they come to the attention then of who I must say is not my favorite pop artist in the world, Justin Bieber?
First of all, and I heard you listening to Justin before I came in, so I just wanted to let listeners know. They came to his attention the same way Justin Bieber came to the world's attention, which is actually on YouTube.
Tell us a very quick backstory of Justin Bieber on YouTube. I mean, some guy literally found him.
Yeah, literally. He had posted, I think, not very many videos of himself doing mostly covers on YouTube. And this guy, Scooter Braun, discovered him and brought him to the R&B star Usher. And together they created the epidemic that is now Bieber Fever that we all have.
That's right. So back to these guys, Legacy, this Filipino-American band. Found them on YouTube.
Yeah, Legacy had been trying to basically break into the industry the old-fashioned way, really since the late 90s. And because they had been hitting so many different walls, they decided, all right, if no one's going to give us a deal in the old-school way, let's do it the new way. Let's go on YouTube and let's just record ourselves in very grassroots fashion, doing covers of some of the biggest pop and R&B songs on the charts.
Let's hear what they sound like. Let's play a cut off their YouTube channel. This is Legacy. Okay, so pleasant enough, certainly not painful, not my style, but that's an entirely different interview. Very quick thoughts on the caliber of their music.
Well, I think they've mastered kind of classic four-part R&B harmony, and they sound as good, if not better, than many artists currently on the pop charts.
What's it going to take then for the major record labels to get smart and say, I got to sign one of these guys?
This is one of the great mysteries. I mean, if you look at the amount of Asian Americans on YouTube versus the scarcity of Asian Americans on the pop charts, that's this big kind of like why question. And some people believe it's kind of lingering old school racism. Others believe that within U.S. pop culture, the idea of Asian Americans as somehow not quite American still persists in many ways. And many others just talk about kind of more basic stereotypes that, in fact, mainstream U.S. culture is not used to seeing Asian American kids who aren't mathematicians or who aren't behind the scenes as DJs.
Yeah. For all that we have in the last 4 minutes dissed Justin Bieber, the guy has amazing power. Right.
Incredible, I mean, power.
Unbelievable market power.
Market power and an incredible pop star.
So does he have or can these guys, Legacy, make it on the backs of Justin Bieber?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's interesting is that he is very aware of why he is where he is, which is YouTube. And he's been very explicit about the fact that he wanted backup singers who were from YouTube. And now, apparently, during his upcoming tour that's about to begin, he's going to be stopping the show in the middle and allowing Legacy to step to the center of the stage to sing one of their own songs with the idea that, all right, I was discovered on YouTube and these guys were too. So it takes away the kind of racial component in some ways and says, look, this is all about YouTube. So if you love me, you got to love them too.
All right, so we'll go out on Legacy singing Justin Bieber, the YouTube clip that got him noticed. We'll play that underneath as we say goodbye to Josh Kuhn from the Annenberg School right at USC down the street. Josh, thanks a lot.
We'll be singing along here. Thanks, Kyle.
No, we won't. Justin Bieber's probably not a bad guy, but the videos of the four guys behind him, they are worth watching. You can do that and see some other Asian American singers on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, picking up where Stephen Beard and I left off, talking about the G8 and the G20 and maybe the G14 someday. The reason there is a G8 to begin with is that they're the ones that account for most of the global economy. Thing is, that's not true anymore. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, points out in a new paper that rich countries and poor countries now account for about half of global GDP each. In another 20 years, developing countries will be at 60%, which means there's going to be like a G100, I suppose, at these meetings. I don't know. Anyway, on the way out, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow scuttled down 145 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ off 36 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 fell 18 points, also 1.2%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this radio broadcast, overworked with overtime.
There are many human resources executives today who are very worried that their very best people, the most productive up and down the company, are going to begin voting with their feet and leaving for greener pastures.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.